Stand, please.
May it please the court. My name is Joseph McMillan, and I represent the petitioner, Salem Hamdan. I've asked to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to begin here today, Your Honors, addressing the issue raised by the court's order on Monday of this week, which was the question of mootness. And our position on that issue is quite simple, and in fact, it's in accord with the government's as set forth in its brief. We think the case is not moot. We think it falls quite squarely within the rule announced by the Supreme Court in the Cibran versus New York case, where the court said that where the issue on appeal is a criminal conviction, as it is here, there is a presumption that adverse collateral consequences apply.
Is that the presumption irrebuttable then?
That's unclear, Your Honor. I think we see from cases in this circuit references to the possibility of presumption. We haven't had a chance to thoroughly review the issues in the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court's jurisprudence doesn't seem to mention the rebuttable. You know, that this presumption is rebuttable. In fact, Cibran talks in terms of, or even Spencer v. Chemna talks in terms of kind of a dual approach, either a presumption or the willingness to accept the most remote possibilities of collateral consequences.
And it's clear, I guess, that if the appellant in a criminal matter dies, it's over, right?
I would. You know, without
well, unless there's a matter of a
on
fine
direct
or something.
Appeal,
yeah.
If the defendant dies, then the case is vacated below.
I'll take the court's word for it.
That isn't a hypothetical. We've had that over the years.
And in
there might in be fact, an exception to that if there's a fine that would be recouped by the estate. But short of that, just in terms of the sentence is over, the death is over.
So. I would note that even if the presumption were rebuttable, Your Honors, the government has stated in pages 2 and 3 of its brief that it does not anticipate being in a position to rebut that presumption in this case. If the court is troubled by the issue of mootness, we would respectfully request an opportunity to brief this and would be happy to supplement the record if that were appropriate. But as I said, our assumption going into this is that this is a criminal conviction, and as such, it falls squarely under the rules announced in Cibran and avoids mootness.
I suspect we will request further briefing on that. I'm looking back and forth between my colleagues, and we might as well announce that we do wish further briefing on the mootness question. We would like appellant to address that in a brief not to exceed just 20 pages sufficient, we think. Or 15 pages to be filed within the next 30 days to be responded to by the government, and not greater than 15 pages to be filed within 20 business days thereafter, with the appellant having a right of reply in not more than 10 pages within 10 days thereafter.
Very well, thank you.
And I hope the clerk got that. I'm not sure I remember what I said.
Well, turning to the merits, Your Honor, the primary issue that is the basis for this appeal is that the conviction of material support for terrorism is a conviction of an offense that is not a war crime, and therefore it falls outside the jurisdiction of the military commission which handed down that conviction. In this case, we have essentially, we stand in a long line of cases in American legal history where, for various reasons, the government has attempted to expand the jurisdiction of military tribunals. And in each case, Article III courts have pushed back on that effort. They have resisted the encroachment of military jurisdiction on Article III jurisdiction.
It would help your argument, I think, if you distinguished between Congress's power going forward to create new war crimes under all the Article I powers, not just defined and punished, but the declare war clause and other war powers clauses, so going forward. And then what we have here, which is before the 2006 Military Commission Act, and therefore the standard is law of war, as in 10 U.S.C. 821, right?
I think...
I realize you want to... You would like to advance the ball on the going forward point, but you don't need that to win here, correct? All you need to show is that under the law of war in 10 U.S.C. 821, material support for terrorism wasn't a previously recognized international law of war crime.
That's correct, and that is, in fact, now a point that the government has conceded. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, to grant this appeal, the court need not even strike out material support of terrorism as an offense.
Exactly. That issue can remain open going forward. The question really is whether, again, like the analysis in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld itself of conspiracy, using the analysis or the same kind of analysis, did the law of war include material support for terrorism as of the time these acts were committed?
Correct. And the acts that were committed, of course, were from February of 1996 to the date of capture of November 2001. And our proposition, our argument, of course, is that during that time, regardless of whether Congress properly exercised its power under the Define and Punish Clause in 2006 to define material support for terrorism as a war crime, as an offense against the law of nations, regardless of what the status was in 2006, it was not in 2001.
Tell me the difference between aiding and abetting, in your view, and material support.
Well, I think the elements of aiding and abetting are set out in various cases in front of international tribunals, and they differ pretty significantly from material support for terrorism. The elements of aiding and abetting would include a completed criminal act, a substantial contribution by the accused to the completion of that act, knowledge that his conduct would assist, and specific intent that crime be committed. Whereas in the Manual for Military Commissions promulgated in January of 2007, which set out the elements for material support for terrorism, there need not be a completed criminal act, nor a substantial contribution, nor specific intent on the part of the accused. In fact, liability for material support for terrorism can be imposed where the accused's only intent is to support an organization knowing that at some point in the past that organization has engaged in terrorism. So that's a very, very low bar, and it is quite different from the aiding and abetting cases, which in some respects the government, I think, relies heavily on. But that option was available to the government under the MCA to charge offenses
and
charge aiding and abetting.
So picking up on my earlier question, If the statute can't be applied retroactively because of ex post facto, so then we're interpreting the term law of war in 1821, and if that means international law of war, there's a debate in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld between Section 5 of the plurality opinion, Justice Stevens' opinion for four justices, and Justice Thomas's opinion, dissenting for three justices, no majority opinion on this issue, of how courts are to go about exercising that authority in interpreting the law of war. Are courts bound to only apply norms that are already recognized in the international law of war when exercising their power under 821, or can, as Justice Thomas suggested, can courts exercise an evolving, flexible, deferential approach going forward and essentially define new law of war offenses? To me, that's a critical issue. What's the nature of the court's power in interpreting that phrase in the statute?
Right, and I think if you look at the Supreme Court precedents which bear on the question, I think the court has said that for in Hamdan, in Kieran, in Sosa, it has identified...
That was a different question.
It was an alien tort statute case.
ATS question, and the language even is... Well... Not unrelated is not the same language.
Well, it's language that calls for, an actionable violation under international law must
law of
be
nations.
Of a norm that is specific, universal, and obligatory. the plurality in Hamdan spoke in terms of an act does not become a crime without its foundation having been firmly established in precedent, a precedent that must be plain and unambiguous. They looked back to the Kieran case, a military commission case, of course, from the World War II era, and they said that the high standard was met in Kieran, where by universal agreement and practice, the conduct charged was an offense against the law of war. So here we see some of the adjectives.
That most tells you that espionage and planned sabotage was sufficient. It doesn't say it's necessary.
Kieran
does not tell you. You cited Kieran, I thought, just now.
Yes.
Was I not correct?
You were correct.
And it seemed to me you were arguing that what was present in Kieran is necessary. Or my question is, does that Kieran tell us what's necessary or only what was sufficient?
Well, I think it describes perhaps what was sufficient in that case, but subsequent decisions, including the Hamdan plurality, really speaks in terms of it being necessary. And that is our position, that there needs to be clear and unambiguous precedent in order to identify conduct as a war crime. And it needs to be recognized by the international community as a whole. Now, admittedly, Congress has...
U.S. precedents interpreting the international law of war would be relevant to that inquiry, you would acknowledge, correct?
I think that's correct. I think certainly U.S. precedent court decisions interpreting the law of war. But here again, we need to distinguish or be clear about what the law of war consists of, and that highlights the difference between the parties in this case. The government
your
has conceded...
It's international law.
Precisely.
Yeah, and because the court has said that.
Exactly, said that over and over again. And the government has come forward with what we think is a radical and unsound proposition, the proposition that there exists an entirely separate body of law, a U.S. common law of war. We see absolutely no support for that, and the government cites no support for that in decisions of American courts. We think it has, in fact, troubling implications because, as the government itself acknowledges in its briefing, it means that military tribunals, military commissions, can try cases only a subset of which need to be law of war violations. And so we see this encroachment on the jurisdiction of Article III courts that we think, you know, American courts and the framers were determined.
I'm not quite sure I followed the last. A subset of which would be law of war violations, with law of war being defined as you define it. Now, as I understood what the government's position, they're not saying they could try things that are not law of war. They're saying there is a different way to define law of war.
Well, that's correct.
I'm not asking you to concede they're correct, but I would ask you to correctly characterize their argument.
No, and I
so they're not absolutely saying that a subset would not be law of war. They're saying it would be defined as law of war differently than what may be the correct definition.
I think their position is that it would be defined as an offense that has been tried under the U.S. common law of war, which, and our position is that is not the law of war.
Right.
There is U.S. practice applying the law of war, and that's what we see in Kieran and Yamashita and other cases. But there is not a separate body of law known as the U.S. common law of war. And when I said that I think we could see that troubling encroachment, what I meant, Your Honor, is that essentially, so long as the government could create a nexus between conduct and any exercise of any of the war powers, we could be faced with a situation where a claim is advanced that this offends a U.S. common law of war. What the government has done, of course, in moving away from the international law of war to a U.S. common law of war is find a new source in the Constitution for this delegated.
Well, again, you don't need to go there, right? In Congress, I would push back on you on the idea that Congress has to be just a follower, not a leader, in defining war crimes. I think Congress has substantial flexibility going forward based on the scope of all the war powers in defining war crimes. And the United States should be a leader in defining war crimes in Congress. But it's a whole different question, which is your case. So that's why I'm going to bring you back to your case, which is should courts our courts authorized exercising common law authority under 821 to do that same thing.
Well, I mean, and I think the answer to that is that its courts are precluded from doing that under a 200-year-old precedent in U.S. versus Hudson and Goodwin, where, you know, the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Marshall says, quote, the legislative authority of the union must first make an act a crime, affix a punishment to it, and declare the court that shall have jurisdiction of the offense. And this is a position that the Supreme Court in a 2001 case essentially, you know, reaffirmed, quote, under our constitutional system, federal crimes are defined by statute rather than by common law. So, I mean, there is no federal common criminal law, and that has been a position that has been accepted by American courts since that 1812.
Now, the government relies on certain Civil War precedents in an attempt to say, actually, this wouldn't require the court to push out in a new direction. This is just applying precedents that are out there. So can you address those?
Yeah, let me speak to that. I think the government has failed to pay sufficient attention to the pluralities discussion in the Hamdan case about the various types of military commissions that exist. And this goes right back to Winthrop's military law and precedent. You know, there are law of war commissions, there are martial law commissions, and there are occupation court commissions. And each of them are applying different bodies of law. So when we look to the Civil War precedents for that U.S. practice in front of military tribunals, those precedents have to be dealt with caution, as the plurality said, because it's not clear that a particular offense being charged and prosecuted in those cases is necessarily a law of war offense. So the blurring of those lines is evident in the government's brief, and it's part and parcel of their assertion that there is a U.S. common law of war. But those lines must be kept clear, and we think the Hamdan plurality provided the guidance that the court should use. Now, what type of commission was the commission that convicted Salem Hamdan? You know, our position is it was a law of war military commission. And again, the plurality in considering the first commission that tried Mr. Hamdan, made it clear that Guantanamo is not occupied territory, it's not under martial law, and therefore the only type of commission left is a law of war commission.
You assume in your brief, in fact, you state rather strongly, that all constitutional protections apply to aliens held beyond the borders of the United States. You also seem to declare that Eisentrager has been overruled and that this court's language to the contrary is dicta. Am I overreading what you're saying, counsel, in those?
Not entirely, Your Honor. You're not overreading it. We do believe that the Supreme Court addressed the question of whether constitutional rights will apply at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in the Bomedien case, and it applied a functional analysis, and it asked the question of whether the respect for those rights or the application of those rights would be impracticable or anomalous, and it conducted that analysis with respect
to... Have we not at least twice said that the Supreme Court there was addressing the suspension clause and not the general full scope of constitutional, full panoply of constitution guarantees?
We have looked at those cases, Your Honor, and we think there's a key distinction between the habeas proceedings, which came before the court in those post-Beaumedienne cases, and the criminal prosecution that is at issue here. A criminal prosecution implicates, you know, a person's life and liberty and the protections that are part of the truth-seeking process in a criminal prosecution, we believe, are fundamental rights, and we believe that they're that due process rights with respect to that issue extend to Guantanamo Bay.
You do understand that while you may think Eisentrager has been overruled, we don't. I mean, you may call it dicta, but we're very flatly in a holding in Al Makula, which nobody cites. I mean, there's no question it's a holding there. And I think it is in the two Guantanamo cases, so Aloda and one other.
And, of course, Eisentrager dealt with a U.S. prison in Germany. And Guantanamo, the U.S. is answerable to no foreign
sovereign. Quasi-sovereign and
Yep. Or are you taking an all-or-nothing position? You'd look at each individual constitutional right, analyze it separately.
Yeah, that's...
You could do that as well, right?
Well, I think you certainly could. Our view is that the Equal Protection Clause is applied through the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment in this case, and that Mr. Hamdan, as the military judge acknowledged, did not receive the same kind of process that he would have received had he been in any other American court. As one of the opinions from the military judge in the petitioner's appendix on the suppression of evidence says, the judge acknowledged, quote, "The result in this case is at odds with what would normally obtain under our law. It is true that in any other criminal trial held in an American court, an accused who was questioned before trial without warning regarding his right to remain silent could not later be prejudiced by the admission of those statements against him." So that was a genuine instance, an actual instance, where the failure to afford what would normally be recognized as criminal procedural rights to an American citizen were denied to Mr. Hamdan. I see I'm out of time, Your Honor, and I'd be happy to.
We'll ship you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal. If my colleagues have no further questions, we'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is John Depew, and I'm an attorney with the National Security Division in the Department of Justice. First, the Court has probably pre-permitted any need to further discuss the issue of mootness, but it's the government's position that the Cibron presumption against mootness announced by that court is a rebuttable presumption, but we do believe that we cannot...
Is a rebuttable presumption,
yes, but the ability to accomplish a rebuttal is a very high standard. The government has got to establish essentially that there is no possibility that the conviction could come back and haunt the aggrieved defendant. We don't believe that we can satisfy that burden today because if Mr. Hamdan were recaptured and put in another military commission proceeding under the military rules relating to military commission proceedings, that prior conviction could be used against him to aggravate his sentence. So We don't believe that we can rebut the presumption here, but we will be happy to discuss it further in our
papers. You'll deal, I'm sure, with the suggestion in Spencer, quoting back to Lane versus Williams, that a further violation of law is his obligation to avoid, not the courts to take into account.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah,
but that was not a conviction.
Right.
But if that's not injury for Article III, when the issue is parole revocation or something other than a conviction, the question is why would it be injury for Article III?
Because the court has consistently refused to extend the presumption to any context other than that of a criminal conviction, because it is found that reason and common sense simply don't provide a basis for such an extension. This is a criminal conviction. The Cibron rule applies, and we don't believe that we can rebut the presumption, as I've said here. Now, where my colleague and I...
I want to thank the government for frankness on that. I would ask both of counsel to consider, I'm not sure that I recall mootness ever being used to dismiss a case in a direct review of a criminal conviction.
We couldn't find one either. The closest,
I think Lane and all the others are some sort of collateral review.
Yeah, the closest ones we could find related to collateral review as well, and that was an additional reason why we didn't think the presumption could be rebutted here. But nevertheless,
the juvenile mail has dicta that seems to say it applies in a direct review, but I didn't find a case where it did. Okay.
And we haven't found any other where it was actually applied. The Perez case from the Second Circuit was, of course, as Your Honor says, a collateral review, and there the defendant was barred from ever reentering the country, and the court said that the government that probably was enough to rebut the presumption. But here our concern isn't about the defendant reentering the country; it's about his going back on the battlefield and committing another offense and placing himself in jeopardy before a military commission proceeding. Now, if I may turn to the merits. The primary dispute between my colleague and myself is what constitutes the body of military law, law of war, that permits Congress to codify an offense as a violation of the law of war and make it subject to a trial by a military commission.
You're agreeing that the statute can't be applied retroactively, the Military Commissions Act?
No, I don't agree that the statute can be applied retroactively. It's our position that all that the statute accomplishes...
To the extent it codifies a new war crime, can it be applied retroactively consistently with the ex post facto clause?
If it codified a new war crime, no, it could not.
Okay, that's okay. So the question turns on then whether this was a war crime under the law of war.
Exactly.
And the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, as Justice Kennedy summarized in his separate opinion in Hamdan, the law of war is the body of international law governing armed conflict. This is one of many examples in the U.S. Code where Congress has expressly incorporated international law into U.S. law.
That's one source, but we do not believe that that is the only source. And I think that the offense of spying...
That's codified, right?
...establishes... It has been codified, but it has now been codified. But the question arises is, what's the basis for codifying? It's not a violation of international law. All international law says about a spy is if you catch the spy, he loses his immunity, and he's subject to be tried in your municipal courts if you have an offense. The question is, where is the offense? What is the source for trying that individual by military commission? And we believe that the court in Quirin answered that question by relying very heavily upon what it called our nation's history, our nation's practice, dating back to the trial of Major John Andre for conspiring to surrender West Point in 1780.
Quirin, the court referred to the international laws of war. The Attorney General, in arguing the case in Quirin, said that, personally, the law of war is the well-established law of nations. You see that in Yamashita. I just don't see this dichotomy that's
quite
come out of nowhere seems unusual to me. You don't see anything like that in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, Supreme Court.
I think you do, Judge Kavanaugh. Bear in mind that in addressing page 602 of that decision, in addressing the question whether conspiracy was a violation of the law of war that the executive, through his unilateral authority, could codify as a war crime, both the plurality of Justice Stevens and the dissenters agreed that it was not sufficient simply to look to international law.
You also look to U.S. precedents applying that international law. Sure.
Yes.
That's just as you would look at other precedents applying that international law.
But they continued that it wasn't sufficient to look to international law. Justice Stevens explained that even if under the law of nations conspiracy wasn't an offense, we had to inquire further. We had to look to what our common law was, citing Quirin and citing Article 21 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which incorporated by implication what he referred to as a separate common law of war.
Separate and apart
from international law, yes.
As opposed to all being one body of law? I'm not sure I see that in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. It's creative, but I don't see it. You agree, let's start with some basics. You agree material support for terrorism is not a war crime under international law, correct?
That's correct. So we have to look to another source other than customary international law.
You also would acknowledge...
Codify that.
Well, I guess you don't acknowledge, but the Supreme Court has often referred to the law of war in 10 U.S.C. 821 as being international law, the quote from Justice Kennedy being one of many, many examples.
That's true, but as I've said earlier...
Yeah, I know you want to...
The Hamdan opinion goes further than that and talks about a common law of war that's unique to the United States. And as I've said earlier, Judge Kavanaugh, I don't see how you can reach the offense of spying, which has never been a violation of international law, unless you acknowledge the fact that there is, separate and apart from customary or conventional international law, a municipal law of war. Indeed, in the Quirin case, although it talked loosely about the law of war, it relied primarily upon United States precedents to establish that spying and aiding the enemy were triable by a military commission. And all we maintain that we have accomplished here in establishing material support as an offense triable by a military commission is to codify an offense that has almost as legitimate a parentage as the offense of spying, that is, aiding unlawful enemy combatants using an armed conflict as a pretext for visiting outrages against the civilian population. If there is a separate body of United States common law of war, that is clearly an offense within that body that Congress could codify and make subject to trial by a military commission.
To repeat what I said earlier, there are two separate questions. What Congress can codify going forward, I think, is a significantly different question, at least potentially, than what law of war includes in 821.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I will acknowledge that in order to win both points on this, including the ex post facto issue, we have to be able to demonstrate that all Congress did was codify an offense that had always existed under our common law of war, under that body of law that we have cited in our briefs that arose primarily during the period of the Civil War, when marauders, bandits, and others not enrolled in the Confederate service but acting on their own committed depredations and outrages on the civilian population. And I maintain that, and we maintain that, that's all that Congress accomplished here, that it codified these ancient Civil War era offenses that always existed. The offenses were always punishable. As the Quirin Court explained, it was Congress's option to determine whether, on the one hand, to crystallize these common law of war offenses and codify them, or to leave them as common law offenses.
Now, when the Department of Defense General Counsel and the head of the National Security Division told Congress, do not codify material support for terrorism as law of war offenses because they're not recognized international law war crimes, did they refer to some separate U.S. common law of war?
They did not, but a Deputy Assistant Attorney General Stephen Engel in the Office of Legal Counsel did. Mm-hmm. And what Mr. Chris and what Mr. Johnson were concerned about was, as you recognize, this is not as plainly a violation of the law of war as, say, killing a prisoner of war. There is a question here.
That alone is a problem if we follow Justice Stevens' suggested approach, correct? That it has to be plain and unambiguous precedent.
I don't think that Justice Stevens' approach applies where Congress takes action. Justice Stevens' approach.
I agree with that potentially, but let's going backward to what we're talking about in this case, it has to be, if you're not relying on a statute or a treaty, Justice Stevens' plurality opinion says you have to have a precedent that's plain and unambiguous, and you just acknowledged, I think, that
I don't think that, as I said earlier, applies to an act of Congress. I think that you need to afford some deference
to
Congress.
The acts before 2006, we don't have an act of Congress. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, you didn't have an act of Congress. You had Congress saying in 2006 and 2009 that what it was doing here was codifying offenses that had been traditionally triable under the law of war or otherwise by military commission, a recognition, in my view, that it understood that there were two sources of offenses triable by military commission.
We can't just defer to Congress's view on what's ex post facto, because that would eliminate the ex post facto clause.
Absolutely not. And we're not asking you to do that, certainly. We're simply asking you to recognize that international law, be it customary or conventional, is not the only source of law to which Congress can look in codifying it.
Now, in the Civil War precedents, which you place heavy reliance on, opposing counsel says those were different kinds of military commissions.
Well, he relies very heavily on Justice Stevens's concurring a plurality opinion. And very frankly, I don't think that a lot of thought was given to what Colonel Winthrop said about this at the time the decision was rendered. Colonel Winthrop made it very clear that, yes, there are mixed military commissions. But when there are mixed military commissions, the offenses are captioned differently. He said, and I will quote, the offense where a civil crime is commonly designated by the charge by its legal name is murder, manslaughter, robbery, larceny, etc., or a violation of the law of war by simple terms of description, being a guerrilla. Therefore, All you had to do is look at the specification, see how it's captioned, and that answers the question, something that apparently the plurality in Hamdan overlooked. Not only this, but Justice Stevens, but Colonel Winthrop not only laid out these three separate categories of offenses, but he delineated what crime fell within each category. In the first category, involving provost courts or martial law courts, said these involve robbery and murder. With respect to military commissions, these involve war crimes, like being a guerrilla. So I don't think that that the assessment assigned to by Justice Stevens was totally accurate in looking what Colonel Winthrop said about these matters. Now, the defendant maintains that this is going to give us inexhaustible latitude to deprive people of their constitutional rights under to have an Article III judge, to have the procedural rights of the Fifth and Sixth Amendment. I believe that reasoning is foreclosed by the Quirin decision itself. Quirin explains that those procedural rights apply only to common law felonies, and that violations of the law of war simply don't constitute common law felonies. And it further cabined the class of offenses that were subject to trial by a military commission by explaining that they are must be offenses committed by enemy combatants during an armed conflict. So,
does Quirin deal with the ex post facto question that Judge Kavanaugh raised?
Nothing in the Quirin opinion deals with the ex post facto conviction. I believe the issue was raised but pretermitted, and I can only assume that the court pretermitted it because not quite, Your Honor, no. Because
not quite all or not quite dead?
The way I recall the opinion is the Supreme Court issued an order.
Yeah.
The executions occurred, and thereafter the opinion was rendered. But as I say, what I think is significant about the Quirin decision is that it did talk in terms of common law of war offenses.
Did it use that term, common law?
Yes, it did. At page 34, page 30, I believe, when you look at the area when they talked about Major Andre's execution, they twice used the word common law of war offenses, as did the Hamdan plurality and dissent. So I think it's rather difficult to deny that there is such a body of law when just several years ago, seven justices of the Supreme Court acknowledged its existence and acknowledged that they needed to look to that body of law, although they came out in a different place.
I think common law is not the distinction. Distinction is between a common law that is international law based and is rooted in norms that are well established in international law and similar to our Alien Tort Statute jurisprudence, or to some separate or distinct U.S. common law of war that you would say can deviate from the international common law of war. Because you admit, I think you're telling us here today, material support for terrorism is not an offense under the international common law of war, but it is a long-recognized offense under the U.S. law of war.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes, absolutely. They are separate bodies of law. The customary and conventional international law, the law of nations that can be reached under the Define and Punish Clause, we submit, is not the only source of law to which Congress can look. It can also look to our customs and traditions, as Colonel Winthrop said, in the history of our wars, since the founding of our nations, to discern what offenses are subject to trial by a military commission. And that, we maintain, is exactly what Congress did with respect to the codification of providing material support.
Slightly different question. Do you acknowledge aiding and abetting is distinct from material support?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. Yes.
Harder to prove, lesser scope, which is correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's a theory of principal culpability. Mm-hmm. This is something different. This is like the common law offense that we've cited before of aiding.
So aiding and abetting precedents don't help you here.
No, we don't. I don't believe that they do. I think we could have charged them separately. And I would point out that while we're discussing Congress's constitutional authority here, We do believe that they have authority under the Define and Punish Clause as well as the war-making powers. When that clause is read in tandem with the Necessary and Proper Clause, just like the courts ordinarily do in implementing a treaty. They don't just look to the four corners of the treaty. They do other things that aid and assist in the formulation of that treaty. No one disputes that terrorism is a violation of international law, particularly when committed in the context of an armed conflict. In the Military Commissions Act, Congress has codified terrorism, but under the Necessary and Proper Clause, it is our submission that they have the ability not only to codify that terrorism offenses, but those that are approximately related to it, to ensure that terrorists will not be able to...
Again, I want to make sure that each side understands the other's position. Is it clear to you that the appellants agree that terrorism is a violation of international law?
One of the defendants' amicuses has said it. The international law scholars have said exactly that.
And I'm not to the amicus.
That is the sense of what I receive, yes, Your Honor. In fact, I would also note
and,
that...
If they're taking the position, as I understand it, that it has to be universally recognized or at least widely recognized and have a standard definition, is there, in fact, an internationally agreed definition of terrorism?
I think there's a core understanding as to what terrorism consists of, yes.
The last time I tried to find an internationally accepted standard or definition for terrorism, I don't think I found one. Yeah. Doesn't mean there isn't one.
In fact, you have a case that says that's about 30 years old. But I would have to say that since that, the House report, certainly in this case...
The cases citing that case are more or less than 30 years old and still didn't find one, I think.
That's true. That's correct. But
I think I wrote one of those citing it, and I've been here less than 30 years. Not much less, but a little less.
I think that today there can be little dispute that terrorism as a mode of warfare...
Okay.
Violates international law. Article 33 of the Geneva Civilian Convention.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. I'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few quick points. First, I think it was clear perhaps from the colloquy with opposing counsel that the court understands that at the time of the charged conflict in this case, from 1996 to November of 2001, there was not a statute identifying material support for terrorism as a war crime. And therefore, we believe we are squarely within that standard described by the plurality in Hamdan as a requirement that there be clear and unambiguous precedent.
That's a plurality. That may be what we follow, but that's not binding, right?
And we would also as well point to the SOSA language, which, although it doesn't deal with the law of war, deals with an international law offense, which must be obligatory, specific.
Your opposing counsel relies a lot on Quirin. Can you address that?
I can, Your Honor. There's a number of things that I think need to be pointed out. The Quirin opinion in our reading very squarely places the law of war within the body of international law. As the Justice Kennedy opinion or language that you cited, what the Quirin court said is from the very beginning of history, this court has recognized and applied the law of war as including that part of the law of nations that prescribes for the conduct of war the status, rights, and duties of enemy nations and enemy individuals. Subsequently, in the opinion, it refers to the law of war as that branch of international law.
But then opposing counsel went on to talk about spying. Can you talk about that?
Right. Now, spying is something that the government places great reliance on, and they are correct that it is not denominated as a war crime under international law, but it does not stand for the proposition. The trying of the offense of spying in a military tribunal does not, there's nothing uniquely American about that, and it cannot be advanced as a uniquely American common law of war practice or common law of war principle. In fact, Winthrop speaks to spying, and he very clearly identifies it as an offense that's recognized by the international community. He writes in Military Law and Precedents, a spy under capture is not treated as a prisoner of war, but as an outlaw to be tried and punished as such. Under the law of nations and of war, his offense is an exclusively military one, cognizable only by military tribunals. So what we have here is a couple of things. We see under the law of nations and the law of war, trying and executing spies is not uniquely American. And also we see the reference to an outlaw status for a spy. Now, you know, there's an anomalous status for a spy. It's a status that the U.S. Attorney General in a 1918 Attorney General's opinion sort of discusses as well. This is an opinion right in the closing days of World War I. Attorney General Gregory wrote, the spy dealt with in the laws of war is not engaged in anything criminal, using the word criminal in a technical sense. Spying within the lines or zone of military operations of the enemy is one of the recognized modes or incidents of warfare. If caught within the lines...
Went on to recognize that while that might be true, that nonetheless, when you are conducting military operations out of uniform and not as part of a regular force, you are in violation of the laws of war.
And that's precisely what the Kieran court found,
Kieran,
and it wasn't spying.
Kieran seems to be calling that there might be other sources than universally accepted international law, might they not? Or...
Well, I think that a close look at the Kieran case reveals that there were four charges, the first of which the Supreme Court drilled down on and really analyzed closely and found to be a recognized violation of the law of war. And that first charge, we would submit, Your Honor, is not spying. It is sabotage. It is crossing behind the enemy lines with the intention to destroy military facilities. And the court came to the conclusion that that was a recognized violation of the law of war. So the government's reliance on Kieran as an example of trying spying in a military commission. Now, spying, we know, was one of the four charges that is later included in the Kieran case. But the court did not reach it. The court passed over in silence the question of whether spying does or does not fall within the law of war. So the reliance on Kieran and the reliance on spying for the proposition that there is a U.S. common law of war is unsupported by a look at the Kieran case. The other...
What was the import of your point that the that spying was not a uniquely American common law?
I think the import of that, Your Honor, is to demonstrate that where the government points to American practice in trying a spy in front of a military tribunal, that there is that comports with long-standing international practice, that in fact that is consistent with international practice and does not represent an American common law of war. So that was the import. The other point that I'd like to mention
under
is
your
deference.
Theory, I think, just to get this nailed down, you don't think a U.S. court applying 10 U.S.C. 821 law of war could push international law into a new direction,
you know,
correct?
I think the most instructive case that the court should look at on that question, Your Honor, is a case that we cite and discuss in our brief, but the government ignores, and it's an old case. It's the 1820 case, U.S. v. Furlong. And in U.S. v. Furlong, we had a statute. We had a statute which purported to prosecute individuals for piratical murder, and an indictment was before the Supreme Court of a foreigner on a foreign ship at sea for both piracy and, or well, for piratical murder. The court drills down onto that and there's no deference to the statute. The court looks very hard at whether or not piracy and or murder are indeed violations of the law of war. With respect to piracy, it concludes it certainly is a well-recognized violation of the law of war, conferring universal jurisdiction. Therefore, Congress had the punishing power to reach out and punish piracy. But it struck down the indictment for murder. And what it says is, nor is it any objection to this opinion that the law, the statute that Congress passed, that the law declares murder to be piracy. These things are so essentially different in their nature that not even the omnipotence of the legislative power can confound or identify them. So not even the omnipotence of the legislative power, says the Supreme Court, will confer law of war or international law offenses on things that Congress may mistakenly believe so. It writes elsewhere in this opinion, in what I think is an accurate description of what's happened with the MCA. The Supreme Court writes, "It is obvious that the penman who drafted the section under consideration acted from an indistinct view of the divisions of his subject. He has blended all crimes punishable under the admiralty jurisdiction in the general term of piracy. But piracy is robbery at sea. Murder is a quite distinct thing. And what we've got in the MCA is admittedly many legitimate war crimes."
This is your broader argument again, right, that Congress doesn't have the power.
Exactly so. That Congress,
going forward,
Congress
yeah.
may crystallize, so to speak, an evolving international consensus and confer greater definitional certainty on it. That's its proper function and role under the Define and Punish Clause. But it can only do so once that consensus has
doesn't
emerged.
Doesn't the Declare War Clause give Congress some power in defining war crimes? I think Hamdi said that one of the incidents of war, when an authorization has been passed, is the ability to try unlawful offenders or unlawful warriors.
The government would certainly argues that some of these other war powers in Article 1, Section 8 are sufficient, but we would suggest respectfully that they are not. And you know, the Supreme Court has spoken in terms of the phrase, the war power, cannot be invoked as a talismanic incantation to support any exercise of congressional power that can be brought within its ambit. Now, what you see in the Toth
that
case
doesn't tell us much. That's a very general comment.
It's not a blank check.
Yes,
like
I
no
got.
Blank check.
Yeah, so that doesn't get you very far in a specific analysis. Yeah.
What we see in a more specific sense, perhaps, is both Toth v. Quarles and Reed v. Covert. And in that case, we see the government had attempted to prosecute in courts martial individuals who were no longer in active duty military. In one case, an ex-serviceman whose crime had occurred during his period of active service. In the other case, a spouse of a serviceman. And in both those cases, the government advanced an argument that the government's, you know, prosecution was justified by both Clause 14, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 14, the power to regulate the armed forces, the power, of course, which sets up the court martial, in tandem with the necessary and proper clause. So we see this theory having been presented to the court that, as in this case, the theory is the Define and Punish Clause in tandem with the necessary and proper clause.
You don't have to win this going forward. You're only talking about if you have to, you can win this looking backward.
Both of those
of those cases have been affected by further legislation since that time, have they not?
Well,
you don't have to concede that legislation is constitutional. You don't have to concede anything about it. But it has been the question of whether a serviceman can be tried by court martial after discharge has been affected by statute.
As has
the extent of regulation, perhaps not of spouses, but at least contractors, some of those accompanying forces.
Right. There have been developments, and I do understand that, but the constitutional
going forward, you don't have to look for, because we don't have to pass on the constitutionality of those statutes in this litigation.
But the constitutional principle that's mentioned in Toth and in Reed, I think, has not been modified, you know, and that is that when, you know, we're looking at the jurisdiction of military tribunals, the court says, in determining the scope of the constitutional power of Congress to authorize trial by military tribunals, this presents another instance of calling for the least possible power adequate to the end proposed. So notwithstanding possible statutory changes to the jurisdiction of courts martial, we see this constitutional principle set forward in those two cases that I believe endures and that has a very, very long history in the United States.
This does call for perhaps not a concession on your part, but at least a clarification. In Quirin, there is some reliance on the preamble from the Hague Convention, that would seem to indicate that the existing language concerning international law is not exclusive, which would seem to suggest that there are sources of international, law of war is not exclusive, that there are sources of law of law other than universally accepted international law. Would that not be at least an arguable position with reference to the Kieran decision?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we would disagree with that. We do not think that the law of war has other sources than outside of international law.
The convention to which I'm referring, which is quoted by the court at 35, until a more complete code of the laws of war has been issued, the high contracting parties deem it expedient to declare that in cases not excluded in the regulations adopted by them, the inhabitants and the belligerents remain under the protection and rule of the principles of the law of nations as they result from the usages established among civilized peoples from the laws of humanity and the dictates of public conscience, which would seem to encompass what you're arguing for, but to leave open the boundaries, because otherwise why would the language have been, if not open-ended, at least open-sided at that point?
Yeah, that's a famous clause that is more admonitory, I think, than anything else that calls on.
Not only famous, it's a clause that is quoted with some reliance by the court in Kieran.
Right, and it basically calls for further elaboration, I think, of the mitigating.
Which would not be needed if we were strictly bound by the then existing laws of war, which it does seem strange that something that is essentially common law in nature could be so rigid.
I would suggest that the law of war has certainly evolved, Your Honor, but in order to actually prosecute a person for a law of war offense, there needs to be that clear consensus, that clear precedent. So it's not necessarily rigid.
Then whence would come the first precedent? That goes back to Judge Kavanaugh's question. Can the United States not be a leader as well as a follower in the year?
I think the leadership can certainly come, but it needs to be the leadership of the international community, not running counter to the thrust of the international community, as we see that sources of international authority that are included in our petitioner's appendix, such as the report from the UN Special Reporter, affirmatively deny material support.
Or the leadership, I realize this isn't your position, could come from Congress, not the court, right?
Well,
I agree. You're not going to concede that. I understand that. But
thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, I think that one of my colleagues has asked to further question of the Appellees Council.
Yes, Your
Honor. For Hamdan, even after his sentence was served, the government could have detained him for the duration of hostilities.
That is correct, Your Honor.
As Justice Stevens said in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, correct?
That is correct.
And the government did not do so, presumably making a judgment that he's not currently dangerous?
Well, that may have been part of it, Your Honor. I don't know what the deliberations were there, and I'm not going to speculate. But he was released. He's back in the evidence.
But he was released, even though you're asking us to uphold the designation of him as a war criminal. He was released, even though the government had the authority to detain him.
To retain him, yes, that's correct. He was released.
Okay.
And I have nothing further. I was going to make some comments about Reed versus Covert, but I believe
unless my colleagues have questions, your time is up.
Yes, and I believe the chief judge took care of my.
Okay,
of my
go ahead, and then if necessary, we'll give additional rebuttal back to the.
I don't think I need anything to say further. Your Honor has covered.
Well,
what
I think Judge Ginsburg may have a question.
Yes,
there is a specific standard, I believe, for releasing somebody from Guantanamo, right?
I don't know that.
Well, some instances we've seen someone is deemed no longer an enemy combatant, and I don't know if it's in conjunctive or in separate cases where it refers to not a threat to the United States.
I'm simply not aware of that, Judge Ginsburg.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know that his not knowing anything requires you to rebut it.
Not sufficient to gain release from Guantanamo.
Okay. I don't know what it is, but people do get released. I thought the place was supposed to, but never mind. Give us a recess.